Good evening. Can you hear me? And I can see you. there's a note that someone has left a black device of some sort on the bench by the pond down there, or by the lake. Has anyone lost anything that sounds like that? Okay. Mystery. Is it you, Mary?
Elgin,
it says Elgin on it.
Yeah, okay. It's battery operated. I don't know what it is.
Okay.
Is it a little clock, a little portable, a little travel clock?
It could be. I couldn't figure it out, but it's about that big and it's black.
Oh. Well, yeah, I think it fell out of my pocket.
Okay.
If you would just leave it.
Sure.
You know, in the mudroom, that'd be great. Or, I mean, in the... underneath the, by the yogi notes.
Okay.
Or do you have it with you?
No, I left
okay.
it there.
Oh, it's still there. Oh, okay. Okay, I'll get it.
I just didn't want it to be rained on.
Hopefully the rain will stay off for a bit longer. There was a question about working with the hindrances. Yeah. We talked about the valley of the hindrances some days ago, but it's not as if we've let that go, bye-bye, and we're far from it. You know, they come and they go, don't they, really? Maybe for some people there's a momentum that's cleared them away, but these habits are strong and they can certainly return. And so the question was about dealing with worry and impatience. And this is just a brief response, really. So we're going into slightly different territory now. But yes, with worry, really the strongest recommendation of the Buddha is to cool the mind and calm the mind through anapanasati, through mindfulness of breath. So finding some way to calm and settle, to bring ease. And with impatience, that question, is it ill will? Possibly, yes. Yeah. It probably belongs more with ill will than worry. I would say impatience. Have some familiarity with that particular one myself. And I do believe, I think that both metta, you asked if metta was a good antidote. Absolutely, for ill will, metta is the antidote, and fear is often involved in ill will, isn't it? And so metta was taught to quell fear and ill will. Mudita, so loving kindness, and mudita also the practice of joy, especially if that ill will arises out of sort of envy or a sense of resentment, a sense of it's not fair, how come they get that and I don't, or whatever, that kind of ill will. It's a kind of feeling of impoverishment and perhaps even helplessness. You know? Somehow someone else has got something and I don't have a pathway to that myself. And so mudita, this sense of sympathetic joy, is very much an antidote to that, very much a sense of rejoicing in the good fortune that others have, rejoicing in that good fortune, sort of recognizing causes and conditions. That goodness arises, good fortune arises out of causes and conditions. I'm not talking about wealth. Or it could be anything really, but we're not thinking about ill-gotten gains. That has its own causes and conditions and generates causes and conditions. But just that sense that, you know, thinking about someone like the Buddha who's went forth from the palace into homelessness, just absolutely determined to find a way out of suffering and went through all sorts of challenges and difficulties, but through determination and strong heart and wisdom and constant reflection and hard work broke through. Wow, I mean, and shared it, passed it on to Kondanya and others, many, many, many others over decades. And here we are, you know, the beneficiaries of that discovery and that, or that uncovering and that teaching, those teachings. Gosh, if nothing else can bring joy, let that bring joy, that sense of, wow, what an opportunity, what a possibility. Such mudita for the Buddha, for all those who have practiced well. These qualities nourish the heart and they build a sense of possibility. It's not that you say to yourself, and if I feel good about that for the Buddha, I'll get it too. But it's more a result of continuing to open the heart in that way. So we'll continue to work with hindered states until they drop away temporarily or permanently. And these Brahma-viharas are such critical supports, so crucial and very helpful in supporting the mind to come into its strength and its capacity to be with things as they are. Yeah? How do we be with things as they really are? See what's what and respond appropriately. Yeah? Sometimes you hear people ask, they want to find out about you. Are you a glass half full kind of a person or a glass half empty kind of a person? You ever heard that? Some people, oh, I'm a glass half full, absolute optimist, that's all, yep, no, things go well, it's cool. And for others it's no, glass half empty, I'm not going to be taken in by all that Pollyanna sort of optimism. It's kind of binary thinking that's ultimately quite pointless. And sometimes we laugh at what we see as the Buddhist response to that, a Buddhist response to that, based on something Ajahn Chah said, not about the glass half full, glass half empty, but that notion that, and this won't win friends, and this doesn't make you the life of the party. Are you a glass half full or a glass half empty? I'm a glass that's already broken, kind of Ajahn Chah talking about the cup, it's always already broken. And we know what that means from the laughter, it's clear. You know what that actually means, right? It's a much more interesting response than I'm a glass half full kind of person or glass half empty, because it sees things as they are. It's not deluding with a kind of blind hopefulness or a kind of super cool skeptical nihilism. It's actually just seeing things as they are. Things, anything that we can apprehend, as we know, is a coming together. It's a compound. A glass doesn't just appear in the world as itself. Hi, I'm a glass. It's fabricated. It's got its uses, absolutely. But we know it's fabricated. We know it, but do we know it at the moment that we accidentally drop it and it smashes? No. At that moment we've forgotten that it was always already broken, because now we're upset. We forgot and we hoped it might live forever. Or might just stay around as long as we do, you know. And some things do. If you think about impermanence on a bigger scale, conceptually it's quite easy, isn't it? You know, you think, well, it was daytime for a while, and now look what's happened. Night fell. Night fell on day. Now it's dark. But most of us sort of have a knowing that in the morning it'll change, there'll be daylight, right? Only for as long as the earth revolves around the sun. It might be a very long time, but at some point the solar system will cease to exist. And then what happens to day and night? Such guarantees, such rhythmic guarantees in our lives. And we don't have to worry, it will be for a very long time, but not forever. Kondanya got this. Remember Kondanya? In the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, read the other night, the Buddha teaches the Four Noble Truths, fresh from his awakening. Four Noble Truths, the fact of suffering, cause of suffering, that there is cessation and that there's a path to that cessation. Kondanya gets it. And what Kundanya gets is impermanence. It gets, that's the description in the sutta. All compounded things arise and disband. We were discussing this earlier. Why is that what it gets? Why is that so primary to that stage, that first stage of enlightenment, to stream entry? He doesn't get it as an idea. He would have got that idea when he was a kid, like most of us did. Things don't last. Most of us got it at some level. He saw it. He saw it in a way that cut through the delusion of permanence, of phenomena. And that experience of seeing the Dhamma, you can't really use these words literally, but being in the unconditioned, that doesn't arise and pass. It's free of the giddying, passing parade of things that come and go. It throws into stark relief the samsaric conditions, the coming and going. Sometimes we don't know something that's right under our nose until we see the alternative, and then something's thrown into sharp relief. And even then, the encouragement from the Buddha, we'll hear more on this soon, the second teaching, in which all five of his ascetic Dharma friends break through completely, become arahants. But the injunction is still, after stream entry, to reflect again and again, to see again and again cessation, anicca, the discontent in that, the suffering in that, dukkha, and the sense of not-selfness in that, or non-essence, anatta, in that which is conditioned and impermanent and unsatisfactory. See this again and again and again, because it's again easy to get your head around it as an idea, although it can also be pretty disheartening to keep thinking, oh my god, everything's impermanent. It's not a thinky thing, it's a seeing and a recognizing. It's experiential, and at an experiential level, it's liberating. And this is a really important distinction. As a conceptual idea, it can be okay if the things that we don't want are impermanent, but it can be really disturbing when we start to think about everything disappearing. That's painful, right? So it's an experience of seeing again and again that wears out the clinging that brings the suffering. I've been seeing a lot of these lately, and I love the way this season in this country is called fall. Yeah, it's so literal, isn't it? It's very descriptive. This is what you see happening, the leaves fall from the trees. And I know when I was a little kid, I just thought they were just different kinds of leaves. You know, there were the green leaves, the yellow leaves, the red leaves, the brown leaves, the crisp leaves. It just didn't occur that it meant death. As a very little kid, because I hadn't done the thinking through or hadn't heard that. So there can be a kind of ignorance of impermanence just because we don't understand, you know, at that childish level. And most of us can probably manage that level of impermanence, you know. You get a bit sick of one season, it's quite nice when the next one comes along, or can be. It has its different pleasures, different losses too. But other experiences of impermanence can be very painful, and we don't want to see them, and we have a lot of strategies to avoid them. When I contemplate in my own life, I have a strong memory. Perhaps I've shared it with some of you before, but it was so striking for me. This time I was a bit older than the kid who thought they were just different kinds of leaves. This time I was about 8 or 9, and we were we were living in the Philippines, and you don't often get to see the circus or a fun fair. It's not wasn't quite the same way of celebrating or culture there, but on this occasion there was a kind of circus and fun fair coming to town, and there'd been much anticipation about where we were going. We were being taken, we four kids, and I was nearly sick with excitement. I could barely sleep. I was just thrilled, and I had to have a nap, and it was so humiliating in the middle of the day to have a nap so that I'd stay awake through the event. There was a lot of preparation that went into this thing, and lots of excitement about this thing. And I remember we parked the car and we were walking toward it, and there was this kind of throbbing, pulsing bit of life right there. There were lights, there was music. It was like I didn't know I was doing it, but it was like a solid object of fun, right? Yeah, I mean, that's ridiculous. And then I got closer, and it's like, where is it? There were the lights and it's kind of bzzzt, bzzzt, kind of snapping on and off, kind of faulty wires. The music was coming out of a kind of weak amplification system. And as you get up, of course, it's not solid colours and sound. There's lights there, and there's a bit of sound. And I could smell the earth, the wet earth. It was kind of a bit muddied and not very appealing. And then you get into the circus tent, and it smells of canvas. And the clown, I remember the face was a little bit sweaty. And, you know, there was that sort of made-up face, but the lips were a little bit hard-set underneath that makeup, you know. And it wasn't, you might think, this kid was a real drag, you know. Take them out on the treat, and they're just a wet blanket. But, no, it wasn't. I had fun. But I remember this feeling of disorientation, all these big people walking everywhere, and nothing felt particularly stable, you know. Go on a ride, and you're sort of upside down, and feeling a bit funny in the stomach, and not sure if it's safe or exciting or dangerous. And, the whole thing is an assault on the senses. And then there was the fairy floss. That looked solid. Big pink fairy floss, and you pick it up and you lick it, and the whole thing dissolves into a mouthful of sugar. You know, you know that stuff?
Cotton candy.
Cotton candy, right. We called it fairy floss, right? Cotton candy. Really. So, you know, all this anticipation and this being sick with excitement about a concept, and then the experiential reality of it being some fun bits, and I know I'm supposed to still be excited, but just couldn't hold on to the whole thing as an experience. And I remember going home feeling quite confused. It was like I'd been sold an illusion. Little bits of fun in there, but I'd been sold an illusion. It was, how come these things that everyone talks about don't add up? You know, that kind of feeling that kids can have. Unfortunately, it wasn't a permanent awareness. Still got deluded by the lights and all of that music. But those moments are worth listening to, aren't they? And even something as simple as a pizza. That's another thing. I remember in the monastery, you know, maybe it was cold weather, we were hungry, and on this particular day it was pizza, hot pizza, and I particularly like pizza. So this country is quite handy to move around in because there's pizza everywhere. But I don't have the same relationship to pizza as I had back then, because on this occasion I thought, sort of, you know, mindfully eating, we're eating in silence, and I picked up the pizza and I looked at it and I was like, so this is a piece of pizza, there's no doubt about that. The colour, the shape, the scent. But as I went to take a bite, you know, you can't have your pizza and eat it at the same time, like the kid. Can you? You can't, right? You can't consummate your love for this pizza in one complete merging. You get, the mouth salivates. Yeah? You get a little bit of scent of something, and then that drops away. Then you bite. And there's textures. Mostly it's soggy and pappy very quickly. And then you get some flavours, a bit of salt, a bit of sweet, maybe a little bit of sour or bitter, depending what's on there, but not the whole thing at once. Mm-hmm. You don't get the solid whole thing. The pizza-ness of pizza does not exist. Right?
Right.
It's obvious conceptually, but experientially, you talk, you chat, you break your mind up so that you think you're having a great experience with your pizza or whatever it might be. But it's an illusion. If you slow it down and take it bit by bit, it's a moment-to-moment sensory experience. We can't have really more than one sense at a time. But when the mind is speedy, it kind of runs like a movie, right? You get the whole action, the live action. But if you slow it down, it's just still frame after still frame, giving the illusion of continuity. And quite literally, when the mind slows down, sometimes it can feel like the film comes off at sprockets. You can get images like that. So you all have your own experiences like this, I have no doubt, where the anticipated joy ends up quite mitigated, yeah. But equally, where the anticipated horror of something is not quite so bad as I thought. But we don't get things in three-dimensional wholeness. It's smoke and mirrors. Yeah. And it's the seeing of this again and again and again that starts to decondition the mind from its clinging. Yeah. And we know from the framework of dependent co-arising, some of you will be familiar with that framework, that description. It's a brilliant description that the Buddha gives, isn't it, of both moments and lifetimes of becoming, birth, aging, and death. Yeah. It starts with ignorance, and that's where the chain unfolds. Ignorance of reality, ignorance. Yeah. And then mental formations, these are kind of past causes, and then you get the whole kind of rolling out of, you know, consciousness, name and form, the senses. The senses bring in information. There's contact with sensory material, with sights, with sounds, with smells, physical touch, with taste. Through the senses there's contact, and then feeling arises. Bing! Those are the current conditions. We have contact and there's feeling. And that's where we have choice. We actually have choice in two points. We have choice there. There's the feeling, and we can stay in our abiding, our divine abiding, the loving kindness we've been cultivating, the compassion, the joy, the evenness, the equanimity. And then the feeling comes and the feeling goes, and it hasn't knocked us off. We haven't gone out after it. Craving, clinging, attachment, becoming. We fuse with it, like the pizza, right? You fuse with the pizza and you become, or through ignorance, we think it's something but it's not. We hold on to it. And a sort of self forms. A self that loves pizza forms for that moment. It's born for a while, and then as the pizza's gone, it dies. But across a life, across lifetimes, this cycle continues. Unless we intervene at the point of clinging, because we know that that's the second noble truth. The cause is through ignorance, clinging, craving, attaching to impermanent phenomena, thinking they're solid, they're permanent, they're self. And the other place that we can intervene is ignorance. Ignorance. Yeah, what's the antidote to ignorance? It's not conceptual knowing, it's awareness. Rather than ignoring, we become aware of reality. And we're cultivating this awareness through the applications on this retreat, through establishing mindfulness in front of us. We're bringing into condition a different, or a kind of deconditioning of dependent co-arising. Stopping it right there at awareness. It's not an idea, it's something that we have to put into practice moment to moment. We bring all of these different tools and medicines to bear on our practice. We see again and again how disappointing it is when we've attached to something that folds down, and it always does. And we start to lose fascination with it. It's not a hostile rejection. It's just a ceasing to move toward. Then it doesn't matter if it arises and passes, because it's not our business or our problem. The Pasaka Gi has a lovely, lovely description of this that I'll share at this point. Some of you will be familiar with her, Pasaka Gi Nanayon, a foremost teacher of Buddhism last century in Thailand. There's a collection of her teachings going under the title An Unentangled Knowing. An Unentangled Knowing. She says, the sensations of the mind that we explain at length are still on the level of labels. Only when there can be awareness right at awareness will you really be able to know that the mind that is aware of awareness in this way doesn't send its knowing outside of this awareness. There are no issues. Nothing can be concocted in the mind when it knows in this way. In other words, and here's a verse worth memorizing, an inward staying, unentangled knowing, all outward going knowing cast aside. I'll read that again. An inward staying, unentangled knowing, all outward going knowing cast aside. You can get a feeling for that in the body, what it's like to stay inward. She says the only thing you must work at maintaining is the state of the mind at normalcy, knowing, seeing, and still in the present. If you don't maintain it, if you don't keep looking after it, then when sensory contact comes, it will have an effect. The mind will go out with labels of good and bad, liking and disliking. And remember at this point, we're not in control of what comes in through our senses necessarily. I mean, we can avoid looking in certain directions, but unless we're wearing earplugs or got our fingers in our ears, we can't really control the sounds that come through our ears, right? We can't control the sensations in the body necessarily. So moment to moment, minute by minute, in a way we're assaulted by all sorts of sensations. So that's not where the control is. It's in what we do, how we respond. So this medicine of a Pasaka Gi is so potent. The mind will go out with labels of good and bad, liking and disliking. So make sure you maintain the basic awareness that's aware right at yourself. And don't let there be any labeling. No matter what kind of sensory contact comes, you must make sure awareness comes first. This has been a reflection I've had for quite some time now. Awareness comes first. My favorite three words at the moment. Awareness comes first. You know, I get it. It's a bit like, for a long time I wondered, what does the Buddha mean when he says, in his many descriptions of this, you know, a young person from a good family goes forth from home into homelessness, there's a root of a tree, they sit themselves down at the root of a tree, and they set mindfulness before them, or establish mindfulness before them. It's the translation of before them that's kind of got me curious. What? But when I hear awareness must come, or merit awareness comes first, then I get that. That's not that how to establish awareness didn't, mindfulness didn't make sense. It's more why that specific phrasing of it. And I see it like when you go to lift a heavy object, there's a kind of getting ready, girding your loins, and then you're ready to pick it up. And I see that setting mindfulness before us is a bit like that. There's a kind of not so much strong will in it, but that determination and that uprighting. Awareness comes first. That's the job. Continuing to rest in, to cultivate this capacity to stay right there with awareness. She says awareness at awareness, and that can be confusing for some, but I'd keep it simple. Awareness can only ever be aware. So awareness is aware of itself. Awareness at awareness. It's simply maintaining, establishing awareness inward, in the body, with the breath, at home. We can be aware of objects out there, of course we can, but awareness at awareness is this sense of staying intentionally put. And then she says, if you train yourself correctly in this way, everything will stop. You won't go straying out through your senses of sight, hearing, etc. The mind will stop and look, stop and be aware right at awareness, so as to know the truth that all things arise and disband. Again, you see, we know that things arise and disband. Conceptually, we know it. But experientially, we'll know it. From awareness. She says, there's no real truth to anything. Only our stupidity is what latches onto things, giving them meaning and then suffering for it. So she cuts to the chase when she calls us stupid for clinging onto things. But it kind of comes from that frustration of, oh, doi, fell for it again, you know. This impermanent phenomenon arising and passing, fell for it again, got hooked again. And the cessation isn't in things. It's not, oh, thank goodness, once and for all, those inane sounds will stop, those annoying thoughts will stop. No, it's the clinging that will stop. Because we'll lose interest in the circus, in the passing parade. It's giddying effects. We get sick of it, sick and tired. Because it is tiring, isn't it? Doesn't it? You know, a fragmented mind, that is not pleasant. Going out here, going out there. Like that cartoon, the outline of the cartoon, and half the colour's in, half the colour's out. It doesn't feel good, even to look at it doesn't feel good. Ooh. So the coming home, coming back home. Now, it can be easier to notice impermanence in a leaf falling down. My life isn't invested in that particular leaf. That can fall. Other leaves will come back in when we're back in spring one time. You know. But I think where this can really hook us and be difficult is in relationships. Yeah? How to relate with this information about impermanence. You know, you can't go around saying, well, everyone here's impermanent, so won't get involved, won't get hurt, won't get invested. No, it's not like that. And for many of us here, you know, very strong and profound personal losses of loved ones. You know, whether it's recent or some decades ago. How do we square that off with this notion of impermanence? Yes, the loss reminds us of that impermanence, but how does it help free us from the pain of that? One quite profound experience for me was with a monk in Australia. He's an English monk. Who I've spent some time going to retreats and he was a very beautiful teacher this was before I went off to the monastery in the UK, but I learned something from him that I didn't even realise I'd never known, you know, was how to relate in an unentangled way. So this monk, you would spend some time with him and he was right there, absolutely present. And then you'd say goodbye and he'd move, you know, just speak to the next person or he'd move on. And there was a sense of absolutely being let go. Not, I don't mean abandoned or rejected, I mean absolutely, it was like a feeling of being set free. And I hadn't realized up until that point that in every other interaction I'd ever had with any other person, there was some kind of little invisible cord between us or something. It's hard to even put a finger on it, but an entanglement, I suppose, at an energetic level. And I only recognized that was going on when I was with someone who didn't do that. Yeah, I don't mean I was doing it all the time with people. I think it's how people into ACT. And it's hard to put a finger on what his practice was, but it wasn't like he was just half there, and then talk to the hand, and then he's moved on. It wasn't like that. It was an experience of complete presence. Moves on. Well, just this feeling of being set free from bondage, from some kind of entanglement. Quite extraordinary, and really quite a profound lesson, actually. It wasn't in what he said. It wasn't that you said goodbye and he said, we'll actually probably never see each other again and I'm letting you go. It wasn't anything in what he did in those ways. It was how he operated in the present moment. That advice to Jatukani, dry up your past, have nothing for your future. I get a feeling that this monk has been practicing a little bit with that kind of notion. Not operating anymore out of memory or imagination, but out of awareness. And there's a freedom, there's a real gift in that that we give to one another. So that's something one can practice. That's a result of practice, but it's something we can practice with one another. How do I move in response to another when we come together, when we move apart? What's there in that interaction? What hopes or longings or expectations are actually colouring that transaction? Or how do I relate in a way that is not transactional, that has something else at its basis than transactionality? I'll love you if you love me, or I'm not talking about this is how I go on about my life. I think this is a lot of how people see relationship, right? Kind of contractual agreement that has some pleasure in it or some whatever, good feelings around it. But the Buddha gives some really powerful examples of how to do this and how to deal with loss. So I'll just read a couple of snippets from these pieces in the Samyutta Nikaya. They felt just so relevant to what some of us are experiencing in this field. Last night a dear friend of the family died. And I got that news this morning, and this person was sick, so it wasn't unexpected entirely. But while we've been here on the retreat, all sorts of things have been coming up for people around loss, current loss, past loss. So this came to my mind as something that may be quite a helpful reflection at this stage of our practice together as well. Chunda is an attendant of Sariputta, and Sariputta has just died. Sariputta, one of the Buddha's great disciples, Sariputta and Moggallana, who ordained more or less at the same time and got enlightened within a couple of weeks of each other. Moggallana first, and then Sariputta. Very, very dear to the Buddha and to Ananda. So Sariputta taught Ananda, was an elder for Ananda. So the novice Chunda comes to Ananda with Sariputta's bowl and robe and tells him what's happened. And Ananda says, oh, we've got to go to the Buddha and tell him. And he says to the Buddha, and I find this such a beautiful example of Ananda's honesty. It comes through so much of the suttas. He says, Venerable Sir, since I heard that the Venerable Sariputta has attained final nirvana, my body seems as if it's been drugged. I've become disoriented. The teachings are no longer clear to me. So human, so we understand it, don't we? This kind of shock that knocks us off course. And the Buddha says to him, Why, Ananda, when Sariputta attained final nirvana, did he take away your aggregate of virtue? Or your aggregate of concentration? Or of wisdom, or liberation, or your aggregate of the knowledge and vision of liberation? No, he did not, Venerable Sir. But he doesn't give up there. He says, but for me, the Venerable Sariputta was an advisor and counselor, one who instructed, exhorted, inspired, and gladdened me. He was unwearying in teaching the Dhamma. He was helpful to his brothers in the holy life. We recollect the nourishment of Dhamma, the wealth of Dhamma, the help of Dhamma given by Venerable Sariputta. And then the Buddha says, haven't I already said that everything is impermanent, that we must be parted, separated and severed for all who are dear and agreeable to us? He goes through the teachings that he's given Ananda. And he says, you know, it's not possible to say, may this being who is impermanent be permanent for my sake. Yeah. So instead he says that it's just as if the largest branch would break off a great tree standing possessed of heartwood. So he puts it back into perspective. So too, Ananda, in the great Bhikkhusangha, standing possessed of heartwood, Sariputta has attained final nibbana. How could it be, Ananda, that we could say, may what is born, come to be conditioned and subject to disintegration, not disintegrate? That is impossible. So that sense that the heartwood hasn't gone. The heartwood is there in the sangha, in the practicing, in the teachings. But a great branch has fallen, and there's no doubt about that. And then briefly, in the next piece, he's gathered with the sangha. It's the huge sangha that have gathered together regularly. And he says, this assembly appears to me empty now that Sariputta and Moggallana have attained final nibbana. So this is the Buddha missing his friends, right? This assembly appears to me empty now that they've attained final nibbana. This assembly was not empty for me earlier, and I had no concern for whatever quarter Sariputta and Moggallana were dwelling in. So wherever they were, even if they weren't here, it didn't feel empty to me. But now that they've attained final nibbana, it feels empty to me. This is really important, I find. This is a natural experience or response to loss. But the ripping, the tearing, isn't part of his experience. So then he says, it is wonderful on the part of the Tathagata, so himself, it is amazing on the part of the Tathagata that when such a pair of disciples has attained final nibbana, there is no sorrow or lamentation in the Tathagata. So he can recognize there's an emptiness. He can recognize that there's loss. But his heart hasn't clung to an illusion that it might have been otherwise. They might have been okay to stick around. So then his advice. Therefore dwell, so to the whole Bhikkhusangha, just as he'd said to Ananda, dwell with yourselves as your own island, with yourselves as your own refuge, with no other refuge. Dwell with the Dhamma as your island, with the Dhamma as your refuge, with no other refuge. And that those who do this will be exemplars of the training. Yeah. So this notion, so he's not just saying, well, they were always impermanent, so get over it. Right? He's feeling the absence, the great loss of these great beings. But he's not engaged in suffering around it. It's a very high standard, I recognize that. but isn't it hopeful that there's this possibility? And he gives a path for it. We don't just have to arrive there. Dwell with ourselves as our own refuge. He's not, in my understanding of it, he's not saying be an island, as in cut yourself off so you won't get hurt again, right? Or be a rugged individualist who's not dependent on anyone. In my view, what he's offering is a utterly new way of relating. You know, you don't really hear about it or see it very often. He's operating in the world through loving kindness, through compassion, through sympathetic joy, through equanimity. He's giving love. He has close connections in his life, but he's not leaning on them. The relationships aren't transactional. It's not a quid pro quo. We'll arrange to live together if you take care of this and I'll take care of that and there's some up here too. It's not a business arrangement. It's the mind that's been hungry and leaning out for pizza and for fun fairs and circuses and all the other things that we can get deluded by. It's seen enough of it that it starts to recognize that these aren't things to lean on, they're not stable. And the mind starts to upright over time through the cultivations, through the seeing. And then real relating can happen. That's where real relating can happen. So it's not about disconnecting, avoiding. It's about true relation that's not transactional and not entangling. So I just finish with, not quite sure if it was there, finish with a recollection of another sutta where the Buddha is wandering into a park where three arahants are living together. And they're described as living in concord, yeah? Blending well like milk and water. Yeah? And he asks them, so how do you do this? And they say to him, we dwell with loving kindness toward one another in thoughts, speech, and bodily action. So they love each other. And they've cultivated loving kindness to this point. They're arahants. And it's a natural expression of the heart. So they operate in a loving relationship. Yeah? When they go on their arms round, whoever gets back first sort of sets up the water and the seating. Yeah? The last person to get there, if they want to, they can finish off the food. Yeah? They'll clean up. It's not a set business arrangement. They flow in with one another, helping one another, noticing what's needed and responding accordingly. You know, one of them says, you know, I think to myself, why should I follow my wishes when I could follow the wishes of these other two? So I set aside my wishes and I follow their wishes. But the thing is, they each do that. They blend like milk and water. They abide harmoniously. In this case, they're living, you know, they're arahants and they've gone forth, so they're also living in noble silence, but they come together every now and then to discuss the Dhamma. We don't have to live like mendicants, we don't have to live like monastics, but we have everything that we need to cultivate the path in that way. It's not like, yeah, but those are kind of fully enlightened beings, what about, how do we even get there? Well, there's a path. And we start by cultivating these qualities of heart, these Brahma Vihara, and living from those. And this is how we learn to relate without entanglement, with deep love, but with the refuge here. This is our safety. And we just start where we are. And we chip away. We contemplate anicca, dukkha, anatta, changing conditions, the suffering in that, the not-self in anything that's compounded. And bit by bit, moment by moment, we learn to see things as they are and respond with freedom that has the qualities of love, compassion, joy, and equanimity. So I'll stop there.